Welcome, everyone, to the Middlebrow Culture Warrior. We are back. I'm Danny Kelly Stallings. I'm here with my buddy Pete Gamble.
Hello. I was going to introduce myself, but then you did it for me, so I didn't know what to say.
Well, right. We're here to entertain you, and the first way that we're going to do that is by providing our top threes. Now, this is our alternative formulation of the Middlebrow Culture Warrior, where we each provide you with the three things that have most captured our attention at this moment in time. In other words, what is grabbing us and pulling us in and making it so we can't look away. So, I've got a top three, but Pete, you've got a top three, so why don't you go first?
Danny, what do you think about van life?
Van life?
Mm-hmm. Like living in a souped up van and driving around the country, being in it.
Pete, I'll tell you what I think about it. If you ran 100 simulations of my life, and this is one of my favorite ways to start a response to a question. If you were to run 100 simulations of my life, probably 30 of them, I live in a van.
That's a pretty good percentage, I would say. That's good. Okay, so you understand this idea. So I have a buddy.
Deeply. I have at least two friends who live exclusively in vans.
Right. Okay. So I have a buddy who's retiring and he bought Toyota Sienna minivan and is having it altered and like having like the seats taken out. It's just, he doesn't have kids. He and his wife just go to national parks and they love doing that.
Which,
and
let me say, just interrupt you for a second and say, good on your friend, because most people go with these Sprinter vans, the big white ones, and he's not doing that, which I think is the right choice.
Well, he looked at the Sprinter van and he just thought the cost was too high. So he looked at the Ford van, which is the, what's the name for it? Somebody knows this, is yelling at me, but Ford has one of these kind of vans too. And then he was like, actually, I just decided to go Japanese. And he said, I was looking at this in the Toyota and we were talking about it. And I was looking around because I own a Toyota pickup truck that's at maybe 150,000 miles and just starts up first time right away. So I started looking up, is it just Toyota? Is it whatever? And I went down a rabbit hole that I'll save you all with. But it comes down to this. There are two beliefs, apparently, in the world of automotive engineering. One of those beliefs is that we make the perfect machine, but in order for it to run as efficiently and as smoothly and as well as possible, there will be maintenance involved. You're going to have to.
This is like the BMW model.
This is like the German model of engineering. There will be maintenance.
Mm-hmm. You got to come in every 20,000 miles.
And you have to. And if you do it, that car will last forever. If you follow the maintenance, like this is what I think people really believe about real fitness. People believe that if I take the right supplements, work out the right amount and smile and hug somebody the right amount of time per day, I'll live forever, right?
Like I'll last forever.
I'll just beat the, if I just apply myself and do clean living throughout. Okay. So that's the German model. So the Japanese came up with an entirely different model.
Yeah, they did.
That people will just not do that.
Right.
So they just build a car. They build a car as if you're never going to take it in for the oil change. Right.
If you don't get it, if you don't get an oil change for like 40,000 miles, you'll be fine.
You'll be fine. You know, we're going to gloss over all of these things. You're never going to get the performance out of it. It's never going to be a perfect machine, but it's going to be a very good machine and it's going to run forever, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I love those two theories because I realize that applies to, if you take those two theories, it applies to almost everything in life. So we were talking about the Microsoft ecosystem and we were talking about the Apple ecosystem. This is something we talk about a lot.
This is in,
we complain this about will be, just in general, right? The Microsoft system, the Windows-based system, has always been a highly customizable system, right? You can build it into what you want. You can do what you want with it. You can scale it in all of these ways. There are these powerful tools that can be manipulated by the user, whereas the Apple system is like, nope, we know that you're not going to get in there and set all of your MIDI sounds and your whatever things to do this, nerd. You just want to have video that's right away and you want it to look fine and you want it to be on all these devices and you want it to be easy. Apple has taken the Toyota or Japanese method of engineering, saying, you know, we don't want to get in the guts of this. You don't want to open the hood of this. You want this to work. And so we're going to try to do that. And it comes with a tremendous amount of limitations. Whereas the Microsoft side, you could say, oh my gosh, I can do whatever I want with Excel. I can build all this stuff, but I have to take 6 years worth of classes just to learn how to do it. I have to become a German mechanic to understand.
And if you take those classes, like I've taken a class in Microsoft Word, I've taken a class in Excel. If you take those, and PowerPoint for that matter, if you take those classes and you become a master, it's so nice. It's wonderful. You can do whatever you want with these products. Anyway, not to dwell on the Microsoft Office suite of products, but Pete, what is, before we get too much further on this actually very interesting philosophical paradigm that you've drawn, what is the actual item in your top three?
The item in my top three is intentional design. And when you look around the world, you see intentional design and unintentional design. The idea that somebody thought this through, like the Japanese, and said, hey, they're not going to fix this car, so we need to build this. This is sort of like what the founding fathers of America did. They built this great intentional design. They asked themselves a question. How's this going to land? How's this going to be?
And they took into account, like the losers that are actually going to use the product and their limitations.
Right. And to them, that loser was landowning white man. That's like the lowest part of the room because.
They essentially planned for Tucker Carlson and everybody who watches his show.
In a way. And what they did is they used intentional design to avoid despotism. And it worked really, really well. It is now finally failing them, right? And the funny thing is when you look at it, they sort of knew the kind of king and like foreign influence issues that could happen. I see it all the time now. And so it's been captivating my attention. This idea of intentional design, did we think about this when we created it? Or do we just expect people to understand it and use it to this capacity? And I feel like that's like the argument right now in the United States. It's the argument over everything from Trump to the budget. It's like this, do we have a plan or are we just trying to build this and only the people who are highly sophisticated, like the wealthy, will be able to understand this and benefit from it? You know what I mean? Like the entire financial system. And it seems to me that it's like at a head where we're going to have, like you said, there's going to have to be better intentional design on our things going forward than there has been. And I feel like we've been since 9/11, basically in the non-intentional design phase. That's my thought. That's my deep thing.
So how does this tie back into your buddy with the van?
It doesn't. That's just where it started, where we started talking about engineering. And I started thinking about engineering and they showed me these two different things. And I was like, that's profound. There's two ways to look ahead at something.
No, you're right.
And decide it. And you can either look ahead to your advantage or look ahead to the advantage of others.
It is a profound concept and only as applied to cars. If you only look at it in terms of the cars, that's a fascinating concept of do you design it for the perfect user? I've spent some time in Switzerland, in particular the Teutonic part of Switzerland, where everything's perfect. And everything gets maintained exactly as planned. And everybody goes in after 20,000 miles and does the checkup and does all the required maintenance and everything. And like the perfect car in Switzerland is not going to be the same as the perfect car in the United States, where people are like, huh, what? Do I need an oil change? I don't know. Who cares? Do I need to clean my air filter in my house? I don't know. I'm not worried about that. Do you plan for the Swiss user, the perfect user, or do you plan for the American loser that thinks about their car only when they drive it and as they drive it? And that in itself is an interesting concept, I think. So that's your number three.
It is the same concept, because you know what that concept is? That concept is the perfect the enemy of the good. Can I build the perfect thing that needs to be handled like all this way? Or should I build the good thing that's just going to work?
Mm-hmm. What's number two?
I found another rabbit hole that I went down that came through office supplies. Danny, as an attorney and as a person who works hard, have you ever used a pen to the absolute end of it?
I do it all the time.
You run pens out of ink?
Oh, it happens constantly.
I was just thinking to myself, I don't think I've ever done that. I don't think I've ever used a supply to its logical end. I've used a pen for a while and lost it. Somebody borrowed it. I bought a new pen. I thought one looked better. I don't think I've ever completely used one to the end. There is, in pen design, the pen that I have never used to the end is this Bic pen. That is the one you've seen. It's clear plastic. It has a opaque plastic top that goes on it. It's the design is unchanged from like
Bic. Just this is like the standard Bic.
Yeah, if you think about it, it's like got 12 a cap. To 16 it's packs. It's not a clicky pen, yep. Right? It's got a cap. Design is literally unchanged from like 1958.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't get much better than that as far as pens go, I believe.
Can you think of other things that are literally unchanged since their inception? Like the same materials are being used. The same design is being used.
Well, I try to think of those. What is the actual number two?
I had this idea. I was talking to a friend of mine who explained this concept to me of like the other thing that is like the pen, and the pen is one of them, is an unchanged IP. So like a Zippo lighter. A Zippo lighter literally has never changed, right? It's got this wick, it's got this thing, it's got this piece of flint. Would it be better to buy all of your materials ahead of time, since you know you're going to make this pen the same way over the next, let's say, 50 years? And just buy and have all those materials? Or is it better to buy materials as you go? Like, do you save money buying ahead, or is it better to buy at the time? If you were in charge of Zippo, could you buy at today's prices 16 million wicks and hang on to them? Would that be better than paying new wick prices every year?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I did think of three things that are perfect and that don't need to be changed, just like that Bic pen. Paper clips.
Okay. Although I imagine there's a tremendous amount of change with the kind of metals used, maybe, right?
Maybe or maybe not, but the design remains the same. Peanut butter. Peanuts and salt. If you want to throw a little sugar in, fine, but you don't need it. And the third one is beer. Beer was perfect, has been perfect. It was perfected 2,000 years ago, maybe. And it changes and there's variations and whatever, but basically it's beer.
The problem with beer is that I think it's gone through unbelievable change in its time. The outcome is correct, but that's like saying, okay, there's a Zippo and there's a lighter. Like, okay, no, lighters have changed dramatically. They still essentially do the same thing. The Zippo has not ever updated its patent. It is the exact same materials every time. Today, as it was in 1938, as it should be in 2057. Right? If you want to, you want this simple device that will light fire. It has a copyright. It has a trademark. All of its patents are the same. They're never changed. It's crazy. I can only think of two, the Zippo and the pen.
And the paperclip and peanut butter.
Peanut butter is going to be a dramatic change.
No, peanut butter, you just grind up the peanuts, put a little salt in there, a little sugar if you want. Same thing with paper clips. That design has been consistent for a long period of time. Printer paper hasn't changed since printers were invented.
No, it used to be much thinner quality. It had to do entirely different kind of ink. It had those perforations on the side when I was a kid that it had to roll through all those printers. There's all these changes. Like the Zippo literally hasn't changed.
We're talking about really small changes to the printer paper. Zippos obviously are releasing new models probably every year that have slight tweaks, just that are about as consequential as the tweaks.
Oh, so you're saying like just the tweaks in like a non-stir version of peanut butter, like Zippo could make a butane version, but there's somewhere just peanut butter can be sold with these three ingredients and nothing else.
Yep.
But probably not owned and patented like the Bic pen.
Is the Bic pen patented at this point? I doubt it.
I don't know, but they still make it to the exact same specifications. Like, it's crazy. It's so enduring. It's never changed.
How about the greeting card? Greeting cards haven't changed significantly in hundreds of years, probably.
I think the Levi's 501 is another one of these that's relatively modern, is still in widespread use, and really hasn't changed. Also, the Chuck Taylor, the Converse Chuck Taylor.
Let's just say jeans in general, because they change a little here and there in the cut and whatever, but they haven't really made
it. Denim itself as pants has been shockingly long. I think there's just some things that human beings got correct and haven't updated.
The blue blazer is another example. How long has that been in fashion? The blue blazer. Blue blazer's probably been in fashion for 100 years.
Probably longer. It's from Oxford. Oxford, it's one of those crazy things about time. Do you know Oxford's older than the Aztec Empire?
Oh my God. Oxford what?
Oxford, the university in England, in Oxford.
Wow.
It's one of those time shit.
So rice and beans. Rice and beans is another thing that hasn't changed in forever because it's a complete protein. You've got it. It's all right there.
Yeah. Everything you're talking about just like early forms of humanity, right? That's like got to be in Mesopotamia was rice and beans or something, right?
It varies a little bit. Yeah. It varies a little from region to region, but the basic concept of rice and beans hasn't changed that much.
Drums.
Whereas like circus peanuts are a relatively recent invention.
Circus peanuts. Yeah, that's very recent.
I mean, they haven't changed since their invention, but they are a relatively recent invention.
Dude, when you think circus peanuts were real candy, was it the 20s, the 40s?
Oh, we're like a candy that people took seriously. No. It had to have been the 20s or the 30s. It had to have been the 20s because post-depression, no one is popping out money for circus peanuts, I wouldn't think.
You think like, but there must have been a time, considering they've been around from now, that they were really popular. The circus peanut must have had its day at the Barnum and Bailey Circus in the 1930s.
It must have coincided with the time that circuses were popular.
Which is the 20s, 30s, teens?
Teens, 20s, 30s, maybe into the 40s. After World War II, people probably weren't that interested in the circuses anymore. You see the kind of like human death on a dramatic scale, and you're like, maybe we're not that interested in seeing a circus freak or like a strong man or like someone riding an elephant. It just doesn't seem that interesting anymore.
We did not make that call after World War I then.
What's number one, Pete?
My number one observation this week is that I have surprisingly odd faith in America. I feel really? Like looking at all of this doom and gloom about everything we've been talking about that kind of goes on in the flotsam and jetsam of our lives, I think America's not going to fall for it. I think that at some point you got to say there's no technicality here. Courts are not going to do it. The Supreme Court is not immune to a charismatic personality who can control a major political party. I saw all of this bad news, but the more I think about it, the more I think America's not going to do it. You got to just kind of say, I live in a country that will go this way or that way. And I've come to the conclusion this week after watching it and seeing this week was a big primary election week. And of course, Trump is doing really well, but not as well as he should be. And Biden looks like he's about to die, and it looks like the world's going to end, but I don't think it's going to. I'm going to just throw myself onto the wisdom of the American people. I think that it's going to not happen. And I think for
that's
no
fascinating
reason than the inherent goodness of people.
I am feeling very strongly in the other direction. So please convince, talk me off the ledge, Pete, because I'm not a doom and gloom kind of guy. And yet I'm feeling very much like this country is done. So tell me why I'm wrong.
If what we're talking about is directly, will Trump get reelected, which is kind of what I'm talking about, but I'm actually talking in a broader sense. I feel like Trump is a classic second act break. So you have, you know, the moral of the story, the hero comes out like on that, what is that? The path of the, what do you call it?
We're talking about Joseph
Campbell's hero's journey. Campbell's hero's journey, right? So you have like, okay, here's this, then they get this part where like everything seems darkest. And that's kind of like right now. But in order for Trump to win, he would need the exact same or a larger coalition than he had in 2016. Or he would need to have a stronger coalition than he did in 2020 because he lost in 2020. And I don't see what Trump has done to persuade any new voters. As a matter of fact, what I've seen in this lose tremendous ground with voters. And I think the big picture is just that. What voters did Trump gain between 2020 and now? What he did do,
I think it's just,
which is,
I think it's just the amnesia.
Yeah. But what
he waited it out. He was like, he did all this crazy shit. And we sat there for 4 years. And one thing that happens, this is fascinating to me because scientists are completely baffled about what sleep does. For example, scientists are like, what the fuck is sleep? We have no idea. But in recent years, they've made some strides and they've come to understand that one thing that sleep does is it drains the emotional content from memory. And I find this fascinating because you have something, some scar that you've got from some interaction that happened at work or at home or whatever, or something that you did or your wife did or your kids did or whatever. And you're like, oh my God, that scar is never going to heal. It's always going to be this open wound. And what sleep does is it takes that memory and it drains out the emotional content and flushes it out until eventually what you're left with is just a memory. And then you're free to take that memory and apply to it the kind of general rosiness and positiveness that tends to adhere to memories in general, where we see only the good things and forget about the bad things. And I think that's what's happened with Trump, is we've had 4 years of metaphorical sleep to drain all the vital energy out of the way that we all felt in 2020 when we were like, this guy is going to destroy our democracy. And all we remember is like, ah, he cut taxes. He was kind of crazy. It was fun to watch, like whatever, you know, and we've forgotten all the mortal fear and emotion that we felt in that moment when we elected Joe Biden, who's a far from perfect candidate, and instead said, Donald Trump, we cannot. We have this emotional urgency to get Donald Trump out of office. And I think that emotional urgency has been drained from our collective psyches as time has passed. And I think that's what has happened to Donald Trump.
I don't disagree at all. I think that's really well said. And that's an interesting part about sleep. What I will tell you is even the emotion out of it, and people are willing to let him back in, especially the most extreme members of his party. For someone who has such an iron hold grip on the GOP, he's winning primaries by 60%. And that can't happen. Those people, 40% of Republicans deciding not to vote for Trump is laughable end to him. I think Joe Biden, if he can stay alive or die soon so somebody else can take place on the campaign, I don't know how that works. I don't mean to be insensitive. But however that goes, I think you can win big. I think it's not going to be as tight as people believe. I think that they are not looking at the big picture. And if they are, they're discounting the common sense of regular Americans, which, as we've, you know, noted before, like has built an unimaginably complex and healthy society. As much as it's frustrating, it towers above the world in almost every area. And as much as we want to look inwardly and get frustrated about it, we are wealthier and safer and have cleaner living than almost anyone else in the world. So with the exception of a handful of these Scandinavian countries, like a group of incredibly diverse, angry, frustrated, standardized system-using bigots put together the same coalition that elected Obama twice, is built. It's just going to be okay. You have to look at America bigger than that. Then it's going to be all right, is my belief.
I hope you're right, Pete. And I hope that your top one, which is essentially America's going to be fine, I hope that that all comes to pass, because I'm feeling the complete opposite right now, which is doom and gloom. And as you might put it, America going down the tubes and devolving into entropy.
Nope, I think it's going to be all right.
So my top three is a little more concrete, but a little more whimsical and a lot more weird and a lot less relatable, perhaps.
You do you. Let me hear it.
And I'm going to start almost with the most important thing. Mine, but it's something that's been it's been simmering for a long time. And so it's not something that's really captured my attention in a meaningful way recently, because it's always been there in the background. My number three is pharmaceuticals. Pete, I am extremely aggressive. Yeah, pharmaceuticals. And I'm talking about legal pharmaceuticals, things that you take with a prescription. I am extremely aggressive when it comes to pursuing positive mental health outcomes. I'm very aggressive with therapy. I'm very aggressive with making sure I get the right combo of pills. And what I end up with as a result of that is a fairly elaborate pharmaceutical regimen that for me works very, very well. So let me start with the general concept that if you go into your primary care doctor, which is where most people get their mental health advice, if you go into your primary care provider and you say, hey, I'm feeling a little depressed, I'm not feeling my best, I'm feeling anxious, whatever, 97% of the time, they're going to recommend that you try either Lexapro or Wellbutrin. They're going to say, have you tried Lexapro? And you say, no, I haven't. They're going to put you on Lexapro. Have you tried Wellbutrin? No, I haven't. They're going to put you on Wellbutrin. And then eventually they're going to say, have you tried Lexapro and Wellbutrin together? And you're going to say, well, no, I haven't. And then they're going to put you on both of those things at the same time. That's like 97% of mental health care in America. I took a little bit of a different approach because I started off on Lexapro, and then they added Lexapro. They added Wellbutrin to the Lexapro. And then they, you know, we did all kinds of variations, changing the doses, what have you, of Lexapro and Wellbutrin. And it just wasn't quite getting the results for me for a variety of reasons. It just wasn't totally clicking. And so what I did is I went kind of whole hog and I did genetic tests. And there's a number of genetic tests that you can get that will give you a lot of information about what pharmaceuticals will give you the best mental health outcomes for either depression or generalized anxiety disorder. And a genetic test, there's a lot of debate about whether genetic tests in this area are actually useful and are actually like a reasonable thing to do that justify the like $300 cost that you pay for it. But in my opinion, these genetic tests are kind of like a Rorschach test or some tarot cards or something like that. Does a Rorschach test actually give your therapist meaningful information? Do tarot cards actually give your psychic meaningful information? Maybe, maybe not. But a good curator, a good psychic, a good therapist, psychoanalyst can take that information and just make it extremely valuable, can make the what comes up in the tarot cards or what comes up in the Rorschach test, they can take it and they can work with it and they can use it. So I think really the key here is coming up with a really creative and open-minded mid-management person who's going to help you find the right things for you. But what I've ended up with is a very elaborate pharmaceutical regimen, that none of which is Lexapro, none of which is Wellbutrin. I take like a little bit of this in the morning, and then I take this thing at noon, and I take this thing, and then at night I take a little dash of this, a little pinch of that. It's taken me from being in a fairly dark mental health place to being in a really, really positive mental health place. I do think that pharmaceuticals are a very, very significant factor in your mental health and in how it operates and how it achieves good outcomes for you. And I think that this is something that's captured my attention over the last 2 or 3 years and continues to hold my attention, is that if you get your pharmaceuticals dialed in and you get just the right things, you will be in a much, much better place. And now we're in a place where you can get, I've got some pills that kind of keep me awake. And then I've got other pills that help me sleep in. And it's just like my life is better. It's sort of a better living through chemistry situation where like I've got everything dialed in and everything's good. And it's like all fairly minor doses of everything that I take to the point where like, I don't need therapy anymore. And pharmaceuticals have really, really taken my life from like a 5 to like an 8. I think that's what these pharmaceuticals are doing for me. And then the rest is kind of up to me. But like not accepting whatever your PCP tells you and instead moving ahead with like a creative and aggressive plan of what actually works for me, not for 90% of the American population, and what actually makes my life better, and being very aggressive about that, I think is worth every Middlebrow listener's time and is something where the return on investment is extremely high. Any thoughts, Pete, about pharmaceuticals?
I'm pro pharmaceuticals also. I'm just kind of pro human experience of finding things in the environment which can actually affect things. And I feel like
that's it.
Pharmaceuticals have done a really good job of like curating this for us in these really interesting ways. The backtrack on not using pharmaceuticals is less convincing than using them. Like if you want to get to this point where you're like, well, wait a second, I don't want to be on this drug to medicate my mood when I'm doing this or doing that. Well, it's like, okay, do you want to take an Advil? You either believe these things work or you don't. You believe we understand how certain properties like can work in the endocrine system, the nervous system, whatever these things are. And we have tested it and replicated it in all these different ways and are still finding things out. Like, okay, if you buy that, you should definitely give it a shot, man. And I think it's extremely, I think it's life-changing for people. And the more that we are open about it, the better. I'm down with it.
Agreed. Number two, Pete, is Uncle Roger.
Don't know.
Are you familiar?
I don't have an Uncle Roger.
Uncle Roger is not my uncle. He is my first YouTube crush. So as a millennial, I think millennials and probably even more so Gen X are very cautious about sort of liking and subscribing and metaphorically committing to a particular YouTube phenomenon or whatever. And
yeah,
being willing to stand up and say, this is the thing that I want. As a rule, I don't like and subscribe anything. But Uncle Roger is the first time that I have considered liking and subscribing. Uncle Roger is
he has the name of a guy who you should not get into his van. Danny is what I'm going to tell you right now. Don't do it.
Well, I'm not about to get into his van. I'm about to get into his sort of metaphorical van. Not actual van, but no windows. So Uncle Roger is a YouTuber. And Uncle Roger is basically, I want to say he's Vietnamese or something like that. But he's an Asian guy. And he takes on this really exaggerated persona of like a 40 to 60 year old Asian person with a highly exaggerated Cantonese accent. And what he does is he goes and he watches videos where people are cooking things and providing information for other people who want to cook things. So it ranges from celebrity chefs to like YouTube videos where he watches people who are cooking things and he kind of critiques them. This guy, Uncle Roger, is highly knowledgeable about things like egg fried rice and Asian noodles that come in packages like ramen and such. And so what he does is he watches these celebrity chefs and these other videos and he kind of critiques them. And it's almost more soothing than funny. So it's an interesting example and maybe one that we could learn from or maybe not. I don't know. He's intentional jokes. The jokes that he throws in there. You should watch Little Uncle Roger, Pete, but the jokes that he throws in there as like he's clearly trying to make a joke in this moment, they're generally not that funny. But what's hilarious about the thing, and again, almost more soothing than funny, is how he knows so much. He's like deeply, deeply knowledgeable about, for example, egg fried rice. And what he does is he watches the cooking videos and he kind of vibes along with them. So the chef will be like, and then you take the olive oil and you put it in here and then you do this and you do that. And Uncle Roger is like, yeah, it's good. Oh, that's good. That's a good tip. Like really good. And in this exaggerated Cantonese accent, and he just kind of watches it and like vibes along with it. And then he'll be like, no, you did that wrong. You can't do that. You have to use leftover rice for this, or you have to do this, or you have to do that.
Like,
and he just goes off
on critique. No.
Yeah. It's highly, highly specific. It's fascinating and it's soothing. And I found it to be really, really interesting. So go Google Uncle Roger, Middlebrow listeners. I think you'll enjoy it a lot. My first YouTube crush, my first example of a time where YouTube has captured my attention.
My favorite thing about YouTube and TikTok, just anything with video, is just watching true experts do anything. Most of what you see in life is people acting like experts or pretending to be experts or saying they're
like on the morning show. You're watching Hoda.
On
the morning show, and they're just like, well, we did this thing. And you're like, you don't know shit about anything.
Right. If you see someone who is really like, my life has been egg fried rice, I understand every nuance of it. And let me tell you about it. Like, that that is a whole like tranche of content that I love. Like one I do watch, I don't know if it's, I wouldn't say it's my YouTube crush. I think it's actually on TikTok now. But is this guy who's a, I think he's like a Chicago paramedic firefighter, and he just watches other TV shows and depictions of firefighters and just screams at them for being wrong and like explaining what it is. And
it's same hilarious. Thing. That's the same as Uncle Roger.
It. There's like this TV show called like Emergency 911. And these people come out and they'll be like, all right, guys, let's get these doors off with Halligans. And Halligans like a kind of pry bar hammer axe thing that firefighters use. And the guy watched the video to be like, that's it, everybody. Don't worry about it. We're good. We got Halligans. We can put away all of our other extraction equipment that doesn't look as cool anymore. We're not going to use this thing that we would always do. You know, it just shows like how our perception of what we, because almost everything you know is through some like person's point of view. I love this idea. You might believe that architects actually are like Tom Hanks in Sleepless in Seattle. Now, you know that Sleepless in Seattle is made up. You know that Tom Hanks is a made up person, but you assume that the screenwriter and Tom Hanks have done a bunch of research and they sat in with these architects. And so when they talk about architecture, they're really talking about it. So you take that as like what it is when it's not that at all. So watching these, especially in things like military, cooking, like real practical things where you can just somebody come in and be like, this is
cooking,
insane.
Cooking,
you would never do this.
Oh, why the fuck are you doing that?
Yeah, it's great. I love watching it. The amount of meta where I'm watching actors pretend to be firefighters to excite audiences. And I'm excited by the firefighter showing how the actors are misleading the audience and actually firefighting.
Yeah.
I'm through like three separations of content to get to the one that I really like. And so for that, I'm down with it. I think it's awesome. I love it.
For sure. And I agree with you.
My favorite thing.
If you've got a PhD in egg fried rice, you should be on YouTube critiquing celebrity chefs who are like, well, here's how you do it. And you're like, no. There's 25 steps and you're fucking up 7 of them and just getting on these people's case.
I would subscribe to whatever the realistic non-NRA version of some military guy that just goes to your movies and tells you, nope, insane, nope. Yes, that's true. Nope, that's not.
Especially,
what is this really?
Especially, and this is what's most hypnotic about Uncle Roger, but especially if probably 60% of the time, he's just like, oh, yep, that's real. Oh, that's good. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. That's
right,
good.
Yeah, right?
Nice work there. Nice work there. Here's why that works. Here's why this works. And then he's like, no, what the fuck are you doing? No, you can't do that. You
know? Why? Yeah. No, that's great. I am definitely going to watch Uncle Roger. You know who else does this good? I've seen attorneys do a good job with this. There's an attorney that I follow who watches movies and is like, no, you can't do this in open court. No, that's not a rule of evidence. No, this would never
But again, if you're handled if conference. You're just a curmudgeon who's like, oh, you know, then you're just annoying.
Yeah, you can't just be
like, well, that doesn't work. You have to be like, well, okay, oh, good job. Okay, all right, this guy did a really nice job with that. Oh, but this one thing, no!
Okay, have you ever watched, Danny, and I'm going to change your life right now by telling you this, because if you like that, have you ever watched Gone in Cinema?
No, Ghanaian from Ghana. From Ghana.
Cinema from Ghana there is this whole genre of cinema, and it's awesome. And I didn't like discover this. This is like a whole group of people that do this. But the way they do cinema is they kind of make these kung fu movies. It kind of reminds me of early Jackie Chan movies. They're not made expensively or anything. I mean, it looks like somebody with a handy cam footage, but the people doing the action are incredibly good and are working really hard without CGI or any stunts, right? So it's pretty compelling. You're watching like guys do kung fu fighting and like chases and gunfights and stuff. And you know that like, dude, no one's checked any of this. But the best, so it's pretty good. It's pretty compelling. The best part of it is that all of them have this inexplicable narrator who comes in out of nowhere and is overdubbed throughout the whole thing. Like it's all after the fact, like ADR or whatever, right? And the whole time we'll just watch it and be like, oh, look at this. Good action, good fighting. Ooh, here we go. This is sexy. All right. And he's like a hype man for what's happening in the movie. And it is the most
like a Lil Jon.
Oh my God, it is the most charming, fun thing you'll ever watch. Like, it'd be like, ooh, this girl, look at her, she's sexy, she's going to, oh, no, there's a problem, run, they're shooting at you! Like, the guys on the film will be doing whatever. And it is captivating, and the names for them are so great. It's like, who killed Captain Alex? That's the name of the movie. And it's like, incredibly talented high schoolers No, incredibly talented athletes are being filmed by high schoolers whose dad watched it and decided it needed to be zhuzhed up. That's what you're watching. It's unbelievable. It's that same guy. Oh, yeah, good, good. Running out. Look at that kid. Oh, and they'll even call out like bullshit. Like, we fell down. Like, I mean, it's just, it's like having an Uncle Roger on every film. I don't know. They're great. And there's like, you can find them on YouTube because people love them. And
this does sound very Uncle Roger.
Billions of weird little tentacles that exist out there. But highly recommend.
Yeah. Number one, Pete, and I'm starting to realize that when we go through these top threes, mine tend to be very specific and weird. Yours tend to be fairly abstract and undefinable. So that's kind of our top three.
These are how our minds work. You're bracketing specific. These are how our weird, where I'm just looking at a mass of humanity and trying to understand it.
I'm just like, have we thought about like toothbrushes and how quickly they wear out? And you're like, actually, the world at large is fucked. And like, here's why. So number one on my top three this week is my New Year's Resolution Fantasy League.
New Year's Resolution Fantasy League. I understand all those words, but not all together.
That is perfectly acceptable because this is a weird thing that I've created. So New Year's Eve is my favorite holiday, Pete. I love New Year's Eve. I love the of sad, but happy, kind of champagne drunk, like looking forward and looking back and sentimental. And it's all encapsulated by kind of like auld lang syne, this beautiful,
it's a lot of bittersweetness.
It's so bittersweet, and it's a friend's holiday instead of a family holiday. I just absolutely love New Year's Eve. It's one of my favorite. It is my favorite holiday. So how my friends and I do New Year's Eve is every year we say, okay, we've got what, 6 to 8 hours to fill on New Year's Eve, like depending on what time your friends show up, here's how much time we have. Okay, we've got 4 people or we've got 6 people, 6 adults or 4 adults or whatever. And what we're going to do is each adult is accountable and responsible for 1 hour of time. And during that hour of time, they're responsible for being like, here's the food, here's the drinks, here's the activity being kind of the most important part of like, here's what we're going to do during this hour. And so everybody brings to the table some specific hour of like, we do something fun during this. Maybe we play a game. Maybe we go on the roof and drink beers. Maybe we do whatever. So my thing this year was, okay, I've got an hour. How am I going to fill my hour? And the first thing we did was everybody looked at their Spotify Wrapped. Are you on Spotify?
It's not anymore now.
No, you're not anymore. Okay, sure. But everybody looked at their Spotify Wrapped, which was kind of fun, but that took about 20 minutes. And so I thought, okay, well, the next thing we're going to do is everybody's going to come up with New Year's resolutions. Everybody's going to look at Q1, Q2, Q3, and Q4, and it's going to list between 5 and 7 resolutions right now for each quarter, right? So you're going to lay out the whole year's worth of New Year's resolutions, and we're going to enter it into this fantasy league where based on who completes the highest percentage of that quarter's New Year's resolution, you either take first place, second place, third place, fourth place, etc. So you gain status and points or whatever by completing your New Year's resolutions. It worked really well in the moment because everybody was just like, okay, I get it. And they sat down and they were like Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4. And they laid out, everybody very quickly came up with like 5 to 7 resolutions for each quarter, which surprised me, but everybody participated and everybody came up with some really good stuff. And now it's carrying forward. We're still in Q1, but like this has worked so well for me and captured my attention so much. It's like catnip for the type A goal-oriented part of my brain that's like, oh, I've got this goal and I need to complete this task. And if I do, I get this very numeric and specific reward of doing well in my fantasy league, which no one gives a fuck about and doesn't matter. But at least I get to say, well, I did this or I didn't do that. It's this accountability meets reward situation where it's just been absolutely fabulous. And so I highly encourage people to adopt a New Year's Resolutions Fantasy League, and I'll be expanding it next year to as many people as I can get on board because I absolutely love it and I think it's really fun.
Yeah, it does sound like you have plotted out the profits from your year fight mentally already. You're already set up. You already got your good plan.
I do, and I'm profiting from it. Every time I finish something, I feel really good about it. And it's like, it's things like, oh, I'm going to go skiing this number of times per year because that's what I want my year to look like. And then I go out and I do it because it's a thing that's been written down and shared with other people. And so therefore, I'm going to try my hardest to complete it. Once it's on the list, then I do it. I can justify it as like an item on the to-do list that needs to get done. And then I go out and ski and it's great and it's fun. And so this has been
the best explanation I ever heard about running a marathon was like, you just ride it all
scroll down and you write it all out and you just get up and say, here's what the schedule says today. The schedule says I go run for this many, for this long. And if you just do it, it'll be fine. You just get it. So it just makes it real in this way.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my number one is my New Year's resolution fantasy league. Anyone who wants to participate, talk to me offline. We'll get it working. We'll get you in the league and we'll all feel good about our type A brains together.
Awesome. I would never do that. That sounds horrible. I don't make any resolutions whatsoever. Not even one. Not even close. It never even crossed my mind.
Really? I love
resolutions. I don't even sit there and say, you know, this year I ought to. No, I just am like, nope. Huh. No. They never work for me. I think they're just things I get disappointed about.
Really?
I think so. I think that they're hard to do. And then you have this goal. I remember having this conversation with my father-in-law and with my dad. And they show you these two different sides of things. But my father-in-law, we were talking once and he was like, oh yeah, I always like to think, what am I doing in 5 years? What's my 5-year plan? How, you know, and my dad used to ask me, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I was like, this is a real basic conversation, but yeah, I understand your point. Great. When I had a conversation with my dad about that, he was like, eh. I mean, how do you know what's going to be important now in 5 years? Is the plan that you need to be able to run a marathon? Is the plan that you need to be able to do that? Your priorities are constantly changing. What you want out of life is constantly changing. There is no right way to do it. And that's ridiculous to put that on yourself. Make resolutions to do things like focus on people more or something, but like those kinds of goals, because what if you don't want those goals anymore? What if other goals come along that should supersede those goals, but you're a hobgoblin to those goals now because you stated publicly that's what they will be and you've got others going in on it. And I think that's the problem is that my favorite quote in all of life is Kurt Vonnegut, who said, we are what we pretend. So we must be careful when we pretend. And when you set yourself up, this is who I'm going to be in 5 years. This is who I'm going to be this year. And then, I don't know, do you set yourself into that? Does that create something for you to either fail or win against? Is winning even correct in that situation? That's the kind of stuff I think about with it. Like, I don't like that. I like the idea for of sure. Like, I don't know. I think I'd like to have goals that are like, I'd like to be happier with who I am kind of bullshit woke crap, but that doesn't ever seem realistic to me either.
That's also the thing is that we have this constant battle between the people we want to be and the things that we want to do, and then just the forces of laziness in everyday life, right? The things that don't have any real positive purpose other than like, well, I didn't do that and instead I did this, but I wish I'd done that. And so for me, what this has been an exercise in is kind of saying, well, I know I want to do X, Y, and Z. And if I do those things, I'll feel really good. But I know that in the ordinary course of business, instead, I will just not do those things. So if I put them on this list, then I'll go ahead and do them and I'll feel better about it and it'll feel good. And if I don't get to those things and if I don't accomplish them, oh, well, it's just a completely made up New Year's resolutions fantasy league. It's not as if there's some consequence if I lose, but just to give it that little bit of extra oomph. And that to me is what New Year's resolutions do. But the problem with New Year's resolutions is you don't write them down. There's no accountability. You forget what they all even are in a month or two. But if you've mapped them out for each quarter, certainly you're free to ignore them and adapt and change as a person. And as my therapist used to say, see what grows instead of trying to force a particular growth outcome on a particular seed in a particular region where it might not work.
I think that's wise. That's the idea. See what grows as opposed to force growth. Like, I think that's
exactly.
To me, the better resolution would be not to force growth on things, but if I could find a way to be like, okay with what it's going to be. I just feel like getting old, most of getting older to me feels like just kind of becoming okay with things. I can't fix this. I just now need this.
Okay with.
Now I need to be okay with it.
Like, okay with like your body or your artistic output or like whatever the things are that are constrained by the facts of real life. Just being like, that's okay.
Yeah, you kind of just have to. Like, I've been married for 16 years now, which feels like a tremendously long time. And the wisdom I have from my relationship is mostly, yeah, you're just going to have to become okay with that part of it. You're just going to have to come okay with that over 16 years, you guys have been fighting about this particular communication style or issue or whatever it is. And, you know, every relationship has hundreds of these. And like, at this point, it's like, I'm not going to keep trying to change this. I've got to just be okay with it. I've got to just see what grows here. What happens if I just accept all these things? You know, like that's kind of like the realization I'm hitting, that the struggle is less important than the acceptance of the world. Like, yep, it's like that. People are like that. And, you know, I feel like it's wisdom, maybe, in like a real small way.
I think so. Here's something that's kind of loosely related, which is that I'm really interested in the way, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, I'm really interested in the way that over time, as you grow older, life kind of loses its zest and its oomph. But recently I've been attuned more to the fact that this works in both ways. So for example, the classic way that it works, where things just seem less interesting. one of my kids' friends recently brought over a VR headset, and it was a new recent model VR headset. And he was like, do you want to try it out? Do you want to try this VR headset and play whatever games are coming up these days and that they've created? And I was like, you know, I haven't tried any kind of VR headset in over a decade, but you know, it's probably more or less the same thing as something I've seen before, some video game, some narrative, whatever. There's nothing new for me. Nothing's going to be interesting enough that I need to strap on this headset and charge the battery and like try out this game, learn how to play. Like, I don't really care. So I was like, no, you know what? I don't care. I don't want to watch this VR headset. I'm not interested. So things are less fun in general. There's less zest and oomph in life because everything, you've seen everything before. And so things don't hit as hard. But the flip side of that is that bad things don't hit you as hard either. For example, I was recently in a fender bender. I was trying to get out of a lane and somebody else was trying to get out of their lane and we collided in the middle of the lanes and we smashed into each other and our cars got banged up and we pulled over and had a conversation. What are we going to do? Blah, blah, blah. Exchange insurance. And you know, my immediate takeaway was not what I would have had when I was 21 or 16 or whatever, which would be like, oh my God, this is a terrible thing. I'm going to have to pay all this money. I'm going to have to redo this thing. I was just kind of like, whatever. You know what the result of this is going to be? More paperwork. And maybe I'm going to have to cough up $600 for my deductible or whatever, but like, who cares? Like, I had the same reaction to the fender bender as I had to the VR, which is like, I've seen this before and it's not a big deal. And so life kind of losing its oomph and zest, it works in both ways. It works for the positive and it works for the negative as well.
That is so true. The Greek god of old age was Jairus.
Yeah.
Mythology and everything. And Jairus was like slow and crippled, but wise and had all this empathy and stuff. Like, they saw these trade-offs. They, you know, the Greeks were like, yeah, it's not fast, he's not good looking anymore, but it has these aspects to it, you know. And
they trade this for this
gods, like, right, yeah, now, but this Jairus is who you go ask questions to, you know, about how this should handle, or how do you deal with this or that. Yeah, you've seen more.
For sure. You've seen more, and the exciting stuff doesn't seem as exciting, and the bad stuff doesn't seem as bad. It's just sort of a regression to the middle.
Everything, just a regression to the middle on a slow curve to entropy.
Everything comes back to that entropy.
Well, that's what it's like. You're in the midst of winter.
It's that time again, Pete. It's time for Fuck 'Em. Fuck 'Em. Pete, I hear you've got a fuck 'em, and I've got a fuck 'em, but let's hear your fuck 'em. What would you like to say fuck 'em to?
Subaru Motors Finance.
Fuck 'em!
Fuck 'em. Through Chase Bank. See, it's the big banks, man. And let me just tell you, I, like 99% of my fellow neighbors, own a Subaru Outback, and I leased it, actually, and the lease is up, and I decided, you know what? I'd like to just buy it because it's great. I don't, you know, and it's in really good shape. Not to mention, pro tip for all you people out there, I bought the car in 2020, kind of before the full swing of the pandemic. And then after the pandemic, cars got more expensive because of supply chain. So I'm getting a screaming deal on this car. It's like 2020 pricing, not 2024 pricing, which is much higher. So anyway,
because of some contract that you signed that said you could buy it.
Yeah, when you get your lease, you have a payoff, right? And so I negotiated that at the time, and that made perfect sense. But then now it's like, phew, I'm saving about $7,000 off of Blue Book because of inflation.
Put it in the bank.
Gonna bank it. But Subaru Motors Finance is not happy about that, and they keep trying to get me to release it and all this other stuff. So finally, I'm just like, I'm gonna buy it. And they're like, great. They quoted me my price. They're like, you know, let us know. And I was like, should I just apply through like where I have it? Because I already have the lease through whatever it is, Chase Bank. And they're like, sure, you can go on apply. So I try to get on apply, can't do it. It keeps crashing. And I'd get like all this information entered and then it would crash. So I call them back and they're like, oh yeah, you really need to use Google Chrome. That's the only browser it really works. And I'm like, who in today's day and age is only working with one kind of browser?
Especially a lot
like
of people.
A multinational a lot of people. Bank. I was just like,
Isn't there just some code where you put it in for the other browsers? I mean...
No, I get this all the time where it's like something's not working. Something that obviously should work is just not working at all. And I call customer service or customer support and they're like, have you tried using Google Chrome? And I try using Google Chrome and it works.
Okay. Yeah. It's just got to be some sort of weird numbers game. So anyway, I do that. And then I'm so annoyed with it because I have a Mac and I don't have Google Chrome. And I'm like, oh, I'll tell my wife she's got a PC for work. So I'll do it on that. I forgot about it. About 10 days later, I get a letter in the mail that was mailed a few days before that. That's like, you're now, your term of your lease is over and you are now in default of your lease and we may send someone to like repossess your vehicle. Like they sent me like, they're going to repo me. So I call up and I'm like, wait a second. I am in the midst of buying this car. They're like, well, that price was only good for like, I don't know, some amount of hours, you know? And I'm like, okay. And I said, what about my lease? And they're like, actually, you're paid through March on your lease. And I said, so what's the concern? They're like, but your lease is over. And I said, okay, but I'm buying the car, right? And they're like, yes, but that needs to be done before the lease is over. Apparently, the lease ended in February. I said, oh, I thought this was all the process of that. She's like, well, it is. I said, okay, is somebody going to repossess my car? She's like, I can't imagine they would. I'll put in a note. I was like, wait a second. You'll put in a note. There's not, she's like, well, it's a different service than ours.
Oh my God.
I'm like, okay. So then I just immediately, I was like, what do I have to do? She's like, well, if you do it within 3 days, we don't have to communicate to anybody or anything about your repossession or something like that. So my wife, who's an attorney, is freaked out. Like, they're going to come repossess the car. And I'm like, no, they're not. I don't think they will. Speaking of which, that's her on the phone. Stand by. Okay, so where was I in my story? Okay, so my wife's terrified.
I was about to just say, you are stuck in this bureaucratic hell of bullshit.
I'm not, and I'll tell you why. My wife just completely destroyed it. It was amazing.
For the listeners, as we were in the middle of this fuck-em,
literally,
Pete's wife called, and I was just thinking, like, good fucking thing your wife is an attorney, because an attorney's job is to deal with bullshit and bureaucratic nonsense and just cut to the chase and be like, how can we escalate this or how can we change the situation or navigate the situation to make it absolutely just go away?
Yeah.
And it sounds like that happened while we were in the middle of this fuck up.
It did. I can totally end this story for you, but let me pick up where I was. So now I'm in between limbo where they're going to come get my car because neither of the things are the same company. My wife is afraid. It's a Sunday or it's a Saturday. So now I'm like, I can't even do anything till Monday. Do I have to like hide my car? Or like, I have no idea what to do. Everything's fine. So I was so mad at Chase that I decided to go through my own bank and got financed and got a lower rate anyway. But then my bank, because I'm on the lease for the car, will not sell it to my wife who is on the loan for the car because she works and I don't. So then they're like, well, we'd have to have you guys get together at one of our branches in person and all this stuff. And that's what I thought I was going to have to do. And then it felt like I was going to have to get on a conference call about it. But then my wife called just now and she said, I was such a jackass to them that they just did it all digitally and we don't have to do it anymore. She's like, I just bullied that thing through. I was so mean. And now you don't have to do anything.
Nice.
That's great.
Ashley and I are very different kinds of attorneys because if this had happened to me, we would have achieved the same result, which is great. Like, which means we both obviously can do our jobs as attorneys. And as a client, you don't care which kind of attorney you have unless you're in divorce proceedings. But essentially, I would have been like, I was so nice to these people and I just charmed them and I talked to the right people and we soft played it and it worked. And now you don't have to worry about it. But I am highly appreciative. I wouldn't say I'm in awe of these people, but I'm very, very appreciative of the people who are able to achieve the same result by just being like
by force.
Mean yeah. and belligerent and just being like, no, you will give me this. You will achieve this outcome for me. And then they do. And like both of those styles work. And that's why it's being an attorney is a cool job because it takes 100% of your attributes, 100% of your abilities, and it uses all of them. And so Ashley's able to go in there and just be like, I was just stubborn with these people and I wouldn't get off the phone and I yelled at them and eventually I achieved a result. And I think that's great.
Yeah. I think it has something. Look, I'm not a lawyer and I just hang out with a bunch of them and you guys are all crazy. But when I see it, it's like, I think it's the kind of lawyer you are, right? Ashley likes litigation. So it's a lot of just like talking to people, taking depositions, being blunt and stuff, you know, as opposed to like, there's more transactional attorneys that are like, they're talking to you about your will. You know what I mean? Like, and stuff like that, where it's like the people who make money are the people who are good at client relations. And I don't think, as much as I, you know, that's not Ashley's favorite thing to do. So there it is. So fuck them, Subaru Motors Finance, for being completely illogical, unreasonable, and draconian in your responses.
Fuck them. Fuck you, Subaru.
Although I really do enjoy the car. Thanks for that. To the engineers of Subaru, I salute you.
Fuck them to the finance. I got a couple fuck them, Pete. And the first is very focused on dentistry. So you know what I mean when I say the hook?
The dental one?
Yeah.
Yes. Like the thing, okay. That's, I think they call it, and you know what I think they call that? An Explorer.
They call it an Explorer. And that is the world's biggest false euphemism, the Explorer. So when you go into the dentist's office, and this is just for cleanings, like if you go in to get fillings or root canals or whatever, they've got more devious instruments, which you expect when you go in for those advanced dental procedures. But when you just go in for a cleaning, they've got this thing that I call the hook. It's a hook. They call it an Explorer, and they get in there and they are exploring your teeth, but it's a hook. I hate dentistry. I've always hated dentistry. I think it's really, really medieval. And as a result, I've got all kinds of dental anxiety. So whenever I go into the dentist, they cover me with weighted blankets. They try to make me comfortable, as if I could ever really be comfortable when somebody's jabbing at my gum line with a sharpened piece of stainless steel. And I can't even swallow my own saliva.
They put weighted blankets on you at the dentist?
Yeah, they used to prescribe me diazepam. I'm not sure if I've got that right, but
is
basically
that Xanax?
Like... no, it's,
what's the street drug name of that so I can get it at a party?
No, I can't think of it, but it's as a street drug, it's not very good because I had some extras after I went, they would prescribe me a bunch of this and I would go to a dentist appointment and I wouldn't use them all, but I'd use a few. Oh, it's Valium.
Oh, Valium. Old fashioned Valium, huh? Like 1950s yeah. Valium.
Yeah, yeah. And I would take it and I'd go to the dentist and it would make things slightly better. But then I would always have a couple extras. So I took it one time when I went to a Phil Lesh concert, Phil Lesh and his crew or his band or whatever they call it. And I took one and went to listen to Phil Lesh play, and it just was sort of a bummer. Phil Lesh is not that good in general, but like, it just kind of bummed me out taking this Valium. So
it's like a downer, right? It's to calm anxiety. It's not to like, I don't know. I think you wouldn't enjoy like an active listening thing with it.
No, and I didn't.
It's like you do that in a hot tub.
Yeah, so I should sit in a hot tub and listen to Phil Lesh. I get you. But the hook, I can't deal with the hook. Whenever they bust out the hook and they're like, we're going to explore your teeth.
Explore.
And then they just start hooking and jabbing and poking
and
your
it's
gums.
The,
and stuff.
It's
I
the find like
that.
The thing that hurts. Like that's what I hate about the hook, the Explorer, is when the Explorer discovers purchase, some sort of treasure in my mouth, that's when they reef on it, you know, like, oh, is that? And you're like, yeah, I think maybe that's the part that hurts. And I know it is now because you stuck a metal hook into a nerve in my tooth and I want to die.
Yeah. God. It's terrible. So if you're a dentist and you're using the hook, but you're calling it an Explorer and you don't think it's going to hurt your patients because you love your patients and whatever, fuck you.
You know what you could do? You could just call it like a probe, right? You can tone down the sharpened hook nature of it by not being like charming.
Or you could just stop using a hook altogether.
No, I think they need to use the hook.
Fuck, dude, they need to use the hook. But I wish dentistry would get to a point where they could scan you or they could x-ray you or whatever, because they take so many different kinds of x-rays and scans and stuff. Can't they just figure this shit out without poking?
I think all those x-rays and like they take these pictures of your teeth with like a wand and all that stuff now. I think those are just boat payments, buddy. I don't think that does anything, because at the end of the day, they still go with the hook like I was 7 years old.
Yeah, dude. And they are boat payments. And we've reached the point in our lives where, and this is a persistent theme in the Middlebar multiverse, is people who have now become younger than us. I went to the dentist the other day and I swear to God, my dentist was like 23 years old.
Oh God, I know, it's terrifying, right? Like you don't have an experience with pain yet.
No, you don't get it. You've probably had perfect teeth your entire life. You don't understand what it means to have somebody whip out like a hook. And this dentist the other day was trying to sell me on this like little Bo Peep way of thinking about the hook. He's like, it's just like a shepherd's hook. Sometimes we call it a shepherd's hook. And just think of like little Bo Peep out there with like a hook, like herding her sheep. And I was like, fuck you. You have a pointy hook.
I'm an adult, god damn it.
I know. Don't poke at my gums and tell me to think about like a fairy tale or like Aesop's fable.
Like, that's insulting.
It is. It was terrible. So
sir,
fuck you.
Like, why don't you just bring in the crayons for me.
Seriously. Only other fuck-em I got, Pete, and this is kind of a weak sauce fuck-em, but when things start to go south with charging cords and connectivity, it gets real spotty. Like you're trying to charge things, or you're trying to plug in to Apple CarPlay or whatever, and the charging, like the lightning connector, gets real spotty, and you're not sure if it's the phone or the connection or the wall unit or whatever, and it just starts to get real difficult. I hate this. I hate it so much. And I buy new cords, and sometimes they work and sometimes they don't. So anyway, it's a big problem when your charging devices start to deteriorate, and it happens sooner than you think it should. It happens after like a couple months or whatever, and then you just enter this hell of charging devices that sometimes work and sometimes don't, and I absolutely hate it. And again, this is a weak sauce fuck 'em, but if you're a Apple executive and you're, I don't know if this is true, but if Apple executives are designing their lightning cords to deteriorate after a certain period of time, so you have to buy a new one, if you're that executive, fuck you.
Mm-hmm. My problem with it is like, dude, I get it. Things break, right? But like, it turns my digital device into old timey analog device. Like I'm jiggling speaker wires.
Seriously.
My Sony Discman is skipping. I got to take that out. And like, all of a sudden it's like, no, this is just supposed to just, it's one-to-one. It's digital. Just play. Why is it cutting in and out? Like that's the kind of thing. Like it should work or not work.
I know. It feels like
you're in between of trying to coax the physical world into accepting the digital device. I hate that. It makes me feel like I'm in my car at 1990.
Or you're jiggling your antenna to try to receive the right station.
We got past this long ago. So it sucks to be pulled back by the device that freed me from it.
And I got a cheers.
Cheers.
I think you'll vibe with this one. Pete, I'd like to say cheers to female medical providers.
Yes, I agree. I am an all-female doctor myself.
As am I.
Not that I am one, but all of my doctors are women.
I've got a female primary care provider. I've got a female gastroenterologist. I have female therapists. Everyone is female. And whenever I encounter a male medical provider, like this dentist I was telling you about the other day who was like 23 years old, I was like, dude, a woman would explain this to me, the Explorer and the Hook, in a way that made sense and made me feel better. But you are incapable of that.
You feel the need to infantilize me.
Exactly. I have no idea.
You son of a bitch. And then you just punch the like, I just want you to lose it to them. What did you tell me I need to think about that as Bo Peep's Hook? How dare you?
How dare you,
sir?
I don't know. I have no clue. I cannot put my finger on what it is that makes female medical providers vastly superior to male medical providers. But all I know is that they are, in fact, so much better.
That is my experience as well. I also have a female dentist, and she's great. I've never asked about the thing, but she's never tried to make me feel like a child for being afraid of it. And I don't like the dentist either, but I'm not getting weighted blankets at the dentist. Good God, man, that sounds like luxury. My dentist still feels like a dentist's office. Are you like going like into a couch, into a conversation space or something?
I just tell them that I have dental anxiety because I hate dentistry work. And I always think about this thing when I go to the dentist, like, okay, here's the hypothetical. Let's say your options for the rest of your life were, okay, you can either die now or you can go to into a place where basically you have to spend 8 to 10 hours a day getting like advanced dental procedures done in your mouth. And you've got like the water dam and they're like using that suction thing. Yeah, and
death.
They're like,
easy question. Death.
Easy question. Would you choose death or would you choose like 10 hours a day of dental work and then you get to go home and fuck around? I would also choose death.
There's no way I could sit through 10 hours a day for the rest of my life if people did. No, of course. Easy. Death.
However, if I were to be offered the same thing with like a nice like female dentist, that would be a different conversation because female medical providers just hit it out of the park and they're great. And I would like to raise a glass of pineapple passion fruit imperial chilling cider to female medical providers.
Hey, Danny, here's something great about this, that across Puget Sound and time and distance, I am also having a pineapple passion fruit Excelsior.
No way. Wow.
Just out of the blue. This is from my own purchase. So just to be in sync with you, bro.
So cheers to shilling. Hey, thanks for listening to the Middlebrow Multiverse. If you'd like to join our army of subscribers, you can do so at patreon.com/middlebrowmultiverse. There's a free option or a paid option that gives you access to bonus episodes that you might enjoy.